The following program was produced in the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Racism has been a part of the American experience since the earliest days of our nation's history. In modern times, one of the American institutions that is touted as an example of racial equality is the military. Today, we're going to be discussing some of the history of the American military with the author of a new book on race, the military, and federal policy. Our guest today is Daniel Kreider. He is a professor in political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He is the author of Divided Arsenal: Race and the American State During World War II. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Now, your book centers around the period of World War II and sort of the run-up leading up to that war. And so I'd like to start by talking a little bit about the presidential elections in 1940. And it seems like both major political parties were really trying to reach out to black voters in that election. Can you talk a little bit about why that was happening?
Sure. It was an unusual time in that neither of the two parties had yet thoroughly captured the black vote. And, of course, only the black vote in northern cities and western cities was available, really, for capture because southern blacks were almost thoroughly disenfranchised. So one of FDR's initiatives in the 1930s was to reach out to these urban, largely poor blacks in northern cities as part of his New Deal coalition of largely poor northerners, urban residents on the one hand, and rather well-to-do southerners, rural residents in the South. And the Republican Party, of course, is the party of Lincoln, traditionally had real connections to black political machines in cities. So they had more of a tradition in pursuing the black vote in such cities. But FDR was reaching out in new ways to try to build and stabilize this New Deal coalition. So the election actually produced a number of interesting sort of new innovations in the ways that the parties attempted to recruit these black voters.
Well, now, was Roosevelt only thinking about winning the election, or did he at that point have an eye toward a potential American engagement in the war in Europe?
I think he saw it coming, even at that very early stage, although I must say I think he was largely concerned in the immediate pre-election period with victory in November. So one issue is that campaigns were much shorter back then. He really only campaigned from, say, August to November. And I think his overriding concern at that point was merely re-election, although I think he did have an eye on Europe and on the Pacific. So he was a master at balancing these very broad long-term goals and was able to pursue both of them at the same time.
So during that period around 1940, what was it like for a black person, a black man, to be part of the United States military?
Very rough. Very, very rough, I think, is the shortest way to answer that question. He was most likely assigned to a service battalion. That's point number one. Overwhelmingly, black recruits were put into quartermaster units, for example, which provided physical labor for the transshipment of material and supplies and equipment. That's point number one with reference to occupation. He was segregated into an all-black unit, point number two. The potential for career advancement was very limited. And generally, the white military police were extremely strict in restricting his behavior on camps and also in cities. The other interesting pattern is that most of the army camps around 1940 that housed black soldiers were located in the rural South, which made it a very hostile environment, both actually inside the camp and on pass or on weekend leave. These black soldiers faced a great deal of discrimination in local towns as well.
In fact, it would seem that it might really sort of inflame racial hatred to have a black man walking around in a military uniform in the South.
This is very, very true. It's very true. And one of the interesting things about the stories at the time are the sort of provocative nature of finding black soldiers with military uniforms and with new paychecks and new opportunities for advancement who are now circulating in these southern cities. The other odd pattern is that northern blacks, who are somewhat more likely to be literate and well-educated, are slightly disproportionately represented in the army at the time. So in fact, what one finds is a large sort of interregional transfer of young black men from northern cities into southern rural counties. And these are obviously black men who are most likely to be more militant as well as better educated, more likely to actually press their claims for rights.
And so that sort of dynamic, one would think, might help to move things along, but at the same time, perhaps even put some of these soldiers in harm's way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. It has some contradictory effects, I think, because these are relatively aggressive young men. They are claiming new rights, and some of them are actually receiving some new benefits from their military service in terms of training and in terms of literacy programs and in terms of career advancement as well. But at the same time, there are real tensions in the South that preceded the mobilization for World War II and that are really inflamed by the arrival of these very large numbers of black soldiers. So it's an extremely tense period in southern towns and cities. The 30s were already a period of fairly routine racial violence, but this added a new dimension and I think a new tension in the context of many overcrowded camp towns in particular.
What were some of the other things that were going on during that period that would add to this tension in the South?
Well, that's a good question. I think that, one thing to remember is that at the same time that these camps are receiving large numbers of black soldiers, many white communities and white families are losing their young white men to the same draft, of course, so that there's actually quite an extraordinarily rapid demographic transformation in many of these small rural towns. And again, the camps are most often placed out in the countryside where land was very cheap. So in some ways, these are the exact counties which are sort of least likely to provide those progressive attitudes that might have facilitated the integration of these communities, not the full racial integration, but merely the comity and the friendship and the tolerance that one might have hoped would greet these new arrivals. It's also a time of very rapid change in terms of other occupations in the South. Many black farmers are actually moving off of farms and into cities to take new jobs in the expanding defense economy. This is also causing a great deal of tension in rural countrysides because white landowners are worried about the loss of black labor, which is really beginning to undermine the efficiency of their farms. This is another dimension of the racial tension at the time in the South. So it's a very complicated and very tense period.
Okay, so you've given us an idea of this sort of scenario that is leading up to the presidential elections in 1940. How did President Roosevelt or other federal officials or agencies respond, or how did they try to manage that situation?
Uh-huh. One of the techniques that FDR had perfected through the 30s was what was called at the time the Black Cabinet system. And what FDR would do would be to appoint a prominent black administrator or political official to a relatively high position in his administration. And in the summer of 1940, prior to that election, he appointed two well-known black men to serve in very visible, very high-profile positions in the war administration. One was William Hastie, who was now what was called the civilian aide to the Secretary of War, responsible essentially for helping plan black troop policy. And the other was Brigadier General B.O. Davis Sr., who was now appointed to this position of Brigadier General and also charged with overseeing the proper utilization of black manpower as well. These are extremely symbolic gestures aimed at black voters. It attracted much commentary at the time, but it was also seen to be, these men were seen to be vehicles through which black citizens could actually push for additional reforms in the federal administration of the war. So those are the two key appointments in the 1940 campaign season.
Now, is this the kind of situation where these men were sort of window dressing? Or did they end up being a lot more sort of activist, and were they able to really accomplish a lot in terms of bringing about greater opportunities and really making a difference?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. I think the administration hoped that they would be rather conservative administrators and essentially field black soldier grievances and adjust these grievances in the parlance of the time without pressing too aggressively for real substantive reforms. The two men were very different in their own personal backgrounds. Hasty was an attorney, a northern man, and he proved to be actually very aggressive in his pursuit of equal treatment in the Army, and eventually was driven from office after about 2 years. Brigadier General Davis, on the other hand, was a career military man and somewhat more conservative and, in the language of the day, somewhat more realistic about the actual progress that could be achieved in a very short period of time. Both of these men were very aggressive civil rights crusaders, and I don't mean to say that they were anything other than that. The administration, on the other hand, hoped that these appointments would actually pacify black militancy. In fact, they did provide a vehicle for additional protest, it seems to me.
Are there specific changes that we can credit these particular individuals with?
There are a number of lesser ones. There are issues involved, for example, with the segregation of blood plasma and the actual assignment of trainees to various units of the Army. The Army Air Force, for example, and also other technical branches, where they had real effects in the actual implementation of policies. But I would also suggest that this is a period when they are part of a new militancy within the Army. They are the mouthpiece for a new militancy in the black community nationwide as well. They are pressing FDR and the Secretary of War directly for more substantial reforms. They're raising the issue of full desegregation. And it's a period when their efforts at the administrative level are given new salience and new power, it seems to me, by the agitation and mobilization of black soldiers in the camps themselves. So there is movement at the elite level in the administration of the Army, but there's a great deal of disorder and protest at the mass level in these camps at the same time. And I think it's the combination of those two things that forces the War Department to view racial issues in an entirely new light.
You mentioned blood plasma, and in reading your book, that's something that was somewhat surprising to me. I wasn't aware that at one point a blood plasma was segregated according to the color, I guess, of the donors, right?
Mm-hmm, that's correct. There were a number of pseudoscientific conclusions that policy was based upon at the time. Some of them actually dealt with black inferiority, such as this question of segregating blood plasma. This relates to the long-standing tradition in the South of actually classifying individuals by race according to their bloodlines. So that has a longer tradition in the ideology of white segregationists. On the other hand, some new sort of pseudoscience at the time actually was more favorable to black interests. It was sometimes thought, for example, that black individuals had better nighttime eyesight or eyesight in the dark and were particularly well suited to certain kinds of assignments because of that. Another common claim was that they had larger and more powerful chest cavities, which could withstand various gravitational forces in airplanes, for example. So it was also a very interesting and very innovative time with reference to the pseudoscience surrounding racial characteristics and both black inferiority and black physical superiority at the same time.
Okay, we're speaking today with Dr. Daniel Kreider. He is a professor of political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the author of Divided Arsenal, Race and the American State During World War II. Now, as the country moved closer and closer towards becoming involved directly in World War II, didn't this bring up sort of a contradiction in the sense that here we were going off to defend democracy in Europe. And at the same time, here on American soil, there was a very glaring lack of democracy. How did that sort of play out?
It was a very important theme in black protest organizations and also among black journalists in particular in 1939, 1940, 1941. And they exploited this contradiction, I think, with great effect. That is, we are actually involved in a campaign to destroy or defeat totalitarian regimes abroad, which are in many cases based on ideologies of racial superiority, while at the same time, domestically, our system of government allows for the suppression of black rights in the South. And this was probably the most powerful overriding theme for black organizations through this entire period. The Pittsburgh Courier, which was an enormous black newspaper at the time, launched what was called the Double V campaign, Victory at Home and Victory Abroad. And it was a theme that was constantly trumpeted by black activists of all kinds. Now, I think, have to be realistic about what kinds of real reforms resulted from this campaign. It gave them a great deal of ideological and rhetorical strength. But it's very interesting to find that the federal government was quite capable, it seems to me, of dealing with these challenges and with restoring stability to the army at this time of real unrest.
Well, are you suggesting that they tried to manage the situation, or you had mentioned that President Roosevelt was interested in dealing with things on sort of a piecemeal basis? Did they really try to avoid kind of the larger issues or bigger changes?
I think they did. And you find administrators talking about this fairly explicitly. In other words, the wartime is no time for social experimentation. The severity of the threat to national security simply compelled these administrators, in their view, to organize an armed force in the most efficient way possible. And in their minds, efficiency was best served by maintaining traditional racial norms and behaviors and practices. So they were very conservative with reference to confronting the discrimination that was involved in Southern race relations in particular. They were very concerned about the possibility of wide-scale social violence that might result from any progressive or rapid reforms. They're primarily concerned with whites and the possibility that they would fight to preserve their racial privilege. So it's a time when, despite the obvious contradictions between our ideology abroad, in which I do believe we were pursuing American ideals, and our actual practices in government institutions at home, despite that obvious contradiction, federal administrators were extremely conservative in dealing with the instability caused by racial discrimination.
It seems like one of the things American policymakers had to be concerned about was any disruption in the in war production, because if they were going to beat Hitler, they had to keep the war production running smoothly and efficiently. And it seems that the kind of racial unrest could certainly disrupt that war production. How did they manage that?
That's exactly the way that FDR understood the problem. And he was very concerned about cleavages of various kinds, ethnic, racial, that might interrupt the full production of the American war economy and our projection of armed force abroad. In the military, there were a number of small reforms. Some of them were ameliorative. Some of them nudged the armed services slightly towards desegregation. Many of the reforms are actually focused on improving policing and improving punishment systems for troublemakers and challengers to the system. But at the same time, there were important innovations in federal employment policy as well, because one of the real contributions of the American nation to the Allied effort was war production, so that FDR also invented new mechanisms for integrating black workers into factories, and he created what was called the Fair Employment Practices Committee in 1941 to actually investigate complaints of discrimination by black workers. And this was really quite an extraordinary and unprecedented ameliorative reform, which offered federal agents to black workers to investigate complaints of discrimination in factories. And this was another mechanism by which the federal government tried to restore social peace and keep all production facilities running at its fullest potential.
I understand from your book that blacks had historically been excluded from certain skilled trades, from becoming carpenters, machinists, etc. And yet, in terms of the war production, those kinds of skills were really needed. How did blacks become, how were they able to become trained in those fields?
Mm-hmm. It was a difficult problem because most of the federal training programs were also closed to black applicants in the southern states in the early stages of the war. And what I think really turned the tide toward the integration and inclusion of black workers was the actual severity of the war itself in 1942, when things looked very bad for the Allies. Japan was advancing almost unchecked in the Pacific. Hitler was pushing very furiously towards the east, as well as consolidating his hold on the western parts of Europe. And war production simply had to be ratcheted up to a level where additional workers were needed at very, very high rates. Then training programs opened to offer new skills to black applicants. This was an important stage in the inclusion of black workers. I would also point out, however, that both in the military and in factories, a large percentage of black workers were employed at essentially unskilled levels. They were employed as laborers, in the language of the time, both in the Army, as I mentioned, in quartermaster regiments, but also in factories where they worked in transshipment units. They worked in very, very low-skilled occupations there as well. And we know this in part because of the records of the Fair Employment Practices Committee, which recorded details of the nature of the occupations of black workers who actually filed complaints. And a large percentage, more than 50% of these complaints from black workers, are actually produced by what we would consider to be unskilled laborers as well. So there's, I would say, a very modest amount of improvement in terms of the occupational status of black workers. Some of these middle-class workers are moving into professional positions, that's true, but at the same time, really tens of thousands of black workers are being drawn into the lower segments of the occupational scale from farms and from domestic service work. So you have tons of unskilled laborers actually drawn into the economy at the same time that those middle-class workers are being promoted forward and upward.
Did labor unions play any significant role in helping to open up some of those skilled jobs for black folks?
They did, although it's something of a contradictory story. Many of the larger organizations at the national level promulgated doctrines of equal access and non-discrimination, so that the CIO in particular in the early 40s is a leader in this regard. The AFL was more retrograde and more defensive with reference to fair employment issues. On the other hand, even in the CIO, when it came down to the local level of workers themselves who are assembling for worker rights, one finds a good deal of discrimination even among white workers in northern cities. So the CIO has this somewhat contradictory position in this story of a national organization which at the highest level promotes black advancement, but at the local level actually defends white prerogative fairly ferociously.
Now, one of the chapters in your book talks about the so-called Negro soldier trouble at Camp Stewart, Georgia, on June 9, 1943. What happened there?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a representative incident of the kinds of disorder that one finds in army camps over the course of the war. Again, as I mentioned, many of the regiments that are being assigned to Camp Stewart, which is about 40 miles or so west of Savannah, Georgia, It's an artillery training center. And many of these regiments of black soldiers are from northern cities, so one finds this kind of tension resulting from the interregional movement of relatively well-educated black northerners. Again, many of them are professionals and attorneys in their civilian life. At the same time that one finds white authorities inside these camps assigning these soldiers to service work, segregating them on the camp, pushing them to the farthest reaches of the camp. Black units were often assigned to actually develop new frontiers of the camp and then turn over the structures that they've built to white units, and then pushing the black units farther out into the woods in this case. And eventually, these tensions erupted in a series of very minor incidents of resistance and policing and punishment over the course of the spring of 1943. And then in June of 1943, there was a full-scale insurrection on the part of black soldiers and black units. And two white MPs were shot and killed, and several others were wounded. We know relatively little about these incidents. There were maybe 15 or 20 of this scale nationwide. Most of them are in the South. And this chapter just tries to describe the actual sequence of events which led to the violence and then also the response of military authorities to the disruption in turn.
So by the end of World War II, how significant were the changes in terms of the place of black soldiers?
I think it's significant. I think it's very significant. And here again, I would return to my general claim is that black soldiers themselves, through the kinds of unrest and resistance that one sees in Camp Stuart, Georgia, as troubling as that is, it demonstrated to military authorities that segregation would no longer be an efficient way to organize the nation's armed forces. And in the past, it was believed that white soldiers simply would not consent to integration. But it appears that to me that this is a turning point when authorities learn the lesson that black soldiers themselves are unwilling to consent to segregation, and that real problems of that may even threaten military efficiency can result from traditional forms of segregation. And I think this essentially inverts the logic of military planners. They now learn that real ameliorative reforms have to be implemented to turn these black soldiers away from insurrection and to begin to draw them into the armed forces in a more fair and equitable way. This still precedes the full integration of the Army by 5 years, but it is the seeds of the movement towards integration when military officials begin to recognize this is a highly inefficient way to organize an armed force, both because you have a good deal of replication and waste in terms of parallel units that simply can't interact. One can't distribute personnel according to intelligence scores fairly and equally because of these segregated units. It causes a number of administrative problems. But I would claim that more importantly, black soldiers themselves begin to actually invert the military planner's notion of what makes an army efficient. And clearly, insurrections of the kind that we saw in Camp Stuart were deeply troubling to the Department of War and to FDR himself.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Our guest today has been Daniel Kreider. He is a professor of political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He is the author of Divided Arsenal, Race and the American State During World War II. My name is Marcos Martinez. Our engineer today is Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening.
This program was produced in the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico.